This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 29th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us as we return to Houston.
On Sunday morning, my street became a river, and the waves of water crashed through my doors and windows and totally flooded my house.
That's Clifford Krause, who lives in Houston. He spoke to us in his professional capacity as a reporter for the New York Times, but also as a father and a husband and a homeowner trying to cope with the floods.
At first, what I tried to do is just put some towels down, and of course, that was totally hopeless. At the end of the night, we had about a foot of water throughout the front of our house, the first floor of our house. So, of course, we're very concerned. We've called up insurance. But many people are worse off than we are. There were people who are actually on their roofs waiting for help. We got some comfort seeing Coast Guard helicopters flying up above. The fire department came by to whisk away people, particularly pregnant women and the elderly. And they had to take them out of their homes and put them in kayaks. That's the way our street looked.
Clifford Krause told us that life is on pause. Routine has been replaced by uncertainty for the grown-ups and also for the kids.
At the moment, being a victim of this, we're thinking really hour by hour, to tell you the truth. I mean, personally, it's, you know, getting in touch with insurance companies, how long it's going to take and how expensive to repair our home. I have absolutely no idea. So we're in a long haul. They've put off school for our 12-year-old through next week. We're hoping that we find shelter someplace not too far from her school. But everything is really up in the air for at least the next several weeks and probably more.
Clifford Krause is used to emergency situations, or at least some version of this. He spent a lot of time covering conflict.
I have covered several wars, yeah.
Maybe that time prepared him for this week. Material possessions will be lost, but life, for the most part, will go on. And as bad as it is, Clifford Krause says he's very aware that it could be a lot worse.
There is no comparison with a shooting war. And this is a different kind of suffering, obviously. This is, I mean, we'll survive this. We'll recover this. Everything's flooded. Our refrigerator is making funny noises, so I don't know what to do about that. But it's not the same thing. The suffering that we're going through does not compare to the suffering of somebody who, you know, loses a loved one, obviously.
My name is Miriam Camero, and I am a case manager for Raices. I am currently the only one here in Houston, Texas, and I am serving approximately 50 to 60 families right now who underwent family detention.
Miriam Camero works with immigrant communities through the group Raices. She says for them, the problems of everyday life just get magnified in a crisis.
Most of our clients have had food shortages. I know that a lot of them either did not have the financial means, nor did they have accessibility to know about the hurricane and then also just the magnitude of what would be happening to it. We also have a lot of other clients that have infants, and so diapers are very much needed. And I know that these are resources that I know that shelters have been asking for. The problem with our population as well has been to have transportation. That's always been something some of the clients that I've been having had difficulties with, not only just during Harvey, but at the same time beforehand. And so they, although their shelter is being in place, I know that Houston is widespread, and for them to be able to get to these shelters, it's been a little bit of a struggle.
We've been hearing stories of desperation and relief, of hope and despair all this week from the residents of Houston. According to FEMA, about 30,000 people will need emergency shelter in South Texas, and nearly 500,000 people will need federal aid. Gerald Eckert is a social services director at the Salvation Army Greater Houston Area Command. The Salvation Army operates 4 shelters across the city that are already over capacity. Gerald, thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to do so.
What's the scene like right now in your shelters?
Well, we have 3 shelters in the Houston downtown area, all running about 40% above their normal capacity. Each of the shelters is taking families from the neighborhoods in which they're stationed, and they're all doing well. The crews are working very, very hard. We've had a difficult time getting relief crews into the downtown area, but all is well at this time.
What kinds of services are being provided at the shelters?
It's really all about relief and safety. It's a time in the disaster where we're providing food in a safe place to be.
And what about your resources, Gerald? Are you well equipped now? Do you have needs in terms of what you're providing to the families and people who are staying with you?
So the Salvation Army prepares for these type of events all year long. We knew a storm was coming, and so we've stocked up our shelters with all the supplies that we imagined we would need. We're pretty sure we can hold out for the next week or so. And as long as the roads become passable, we should be okay at this point in time. Right now, it's really about rescue and support and safety. You know, once the roads become passable and the storms begins to abate, then we'll look more at the ongoing support. Because in Houston, Salvation Army is really about stabilizing families. And of course, this event is a whole new level.
Now, you mentioned your shelters operating about 40% over capacity. Is that a steady number now? Are people still coming in and driving that number higher?
Yes, people are still coming in. The city has opened a number of emergency shelters as well. We're directing people who can make it to the larger shelters that the city is running, but there are people who can't make it to those locations, and they continue to come to ours.
And what are you hearing from people as you go bed to bed or cot to cot or family to family? I know you're seeing them personally. What are you hearing from them, and what do you say?
Well, we're hearing from them that they're grateful to be alive and that they're not focused on their stuff at this point in time. It's kind of an amazing situation. Once they're feeling safe and on firm ground and fed, there's so many of people that want to already start to help and volunteer, and it's kind of an amazing situation here in Houston. You know, we're at the beginning. There's still rain coming, and with the levees being opened up, we're not sure how much more of the city is going to flood. But so far, we've really seen an outpouring of support in the neighborhood where we're stationed. We have neighbors coming in to volunteer as well, and supporting the people who are coming in every way we can.
Gerald Eckert, I imagine as you go from family to family in one of your shelters, you probably see a lot of scared and bewildered kids. What can you say to them?
That they're in a safe place, that we're here to help them. Their parent is with them. Most of them are actually very tired and sleeping when they first get fed, and then it's in the morning. There's a lot of questions. We have at our family shelter, though, a designated area for children, and so we have a lot of games going on and people playing with them in that way. The other 2 shelters, it's a little bit of a different situation because we don't have those type of facilities. But the good thing that's happening at those locations as well is people from the neighborhood coming to play with the children as well.
Well, Gerald Eckert, you've been in this work a long time, I know. Have you ever seen anything like this in Houston?
We tend to get floods every year for the last couple years, pretty devastating neighborhood floods. This one is really all across the city. There is not a certain part of the city that's worse off than others. There's no demographic, there's no socioeconomic level that's not been affected by this flood. I was actually hired by the Salvation Army for Katrina recovery here in Houston when we had 200,000 plus families seek safety here. We thought that was going to go for a year. That project ended up being 3 years. Right now in Houston, it's all about safety and recovery, but there's going to be a long way to go.
Gerald Eckert, we wish you the best of luck in the work that you have ahead of you with the residents of Houston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Gerald Eckert is a social services director at the Salvation Army Greater Houston Area Command. More voices now from the devastation in Houston.
My name is Pastor Candy O'Mara. I am the pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in LaGrange, Texas.
My name is Mary Herwald, and I am the Director of Marketing and Communications at Austin Pets Alive.
I'm Bennett Teer. I live in a little addition in Texas called Pinewood Estates. I've lived there since 2010. Around Saturday, we got a little bit concerned and started watching the gauging levels on Pine Island Bayou, which is the body of water that's a concern to us. And, you know, they looked like they were rising at a fairly predictable rate, so really we didn't panic too much, but jumped to Monday morning, the water jumped a full, at least 2 foot, and was nearly in my home, and we thought we had 12 to 24 hours to make a decision whether or not to evacuate. That turned into, we've got about 20 minutes.
Well, we have a lot of folks in the community that are hurting right now. Some of the folks that were giving care were themselves in need of care because members of their family or their houses themselves were underwater, and they were in here doing that. And some members of the community just stepping up in spades. And I see that happening. We're going to see that more and more as the days and weeks go on. As we begin to assess what's happening here or what has happened here and what we need to do to fix it. So I'm pretty optimistic.
So far, we have been able to save over 330 animals. Sometimes owners are trying to evacuate from these areas themselves and they cannot find a way to bring their animals with them, and so they end up being abandoned. Sometimes in the chaos of a disaster situation, the animals are simply lost and their owners are stuck searching for them and just hoping that they got out alive. Any stray populations in cities are also at serious risk, in this case of drowning or being stranded. And so we really try to help animals at all of these different levels.
You know, the number one thing I'm thinking about right now is my family's safe. And that was my number one goal this morning. You know, my house, my neighbors called me and they FaceTimed me and they went through my house and showed me the water that was in it. And now that I know that my home is going to be a long time coming back, you know, that gives me pause and certainly saddens me. We've worked a lot on that house. But, you know, at the end of the day, brother, it's just property. And we'll rebuild and move on from there. I'm just glad to be out of that mess.
We'll have more coverage of the storm and its aftermath later this hour. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com.
One feature of the national controversy over policing after Ferguson in 2014 was images of militarized police on American streets, in heavy armor, driving heavy vehicles. In May of 2015, President Obama banned the military from sending surplus hardware to state and local police forces. Then, on Monday, at a Fraternal Order of Police conference in Nashville, Tennessee, Attorney General Jeff Sessions had this news from his boss, President Trump.
He is rescinding restrictions from the prior administration that limited your agency's ability to get equipment through federal programs, including life-saving gear.
What the Attorney General just said there means that police departments will again have access to Humvees and armored personnel carriers and other equipment. It's another in the long list of Obama administration actions President Trump has overturned. Dr. Cedric Alexander is deputy mayor of Rochester, New York. He was director of public safety in DeKalb County, Georgia, and served on President Obama's task force on 21st century policing. Dr. Alexander, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
The ban on selling military equipment to police departments came after America watched a lot of this gear on the streets in Missouri and elsewhere after Ferguson. What did you think of the Obama administration's decision to ban those sales a couple of years ago to police departments?
Well, first of all, they weren't sales. Those were surplus items that was taken for the military in previous years and given to police departments who wanted it. Following Ferguson, I think many of us would agree that the optic of what we saw militarized vehicles and equipment used against American citizens exercising their First Amendment rights created a great deal of pause and concern for a lot of people across the country. And of course, there we also have to keep in mind, Todd, that we also live in a very different time today. And it does require that our police officers are protected. It requires that they need equipment to go out there to make rescues against those subjects who may be foreign or domestic terrorists who come very heavily armed with assault rifles and equipment that could do harm. So we certainly do want our police departments to be protected, but we certainly have to give some real thought as to when we utilize that equipment. And what I have always said, if President Trump is going to introduce this equipment back to police departments across the country, it becomes important that we make sure we have training on that equipment. We have policy that is written that will describe when, where, and how this equipment will be used. And you must allow the community to have some input, to sit down with the chiefs and elected officials and talk about when is that type of equipment best introduced. Because what we cannot have is military-style equipment or anything that gives the appearance of military-style equipment roaming the streets of American cities merely because there's some civil unrest. American people are not going to allow that, and neither are the elected officials in those cities either.
There was a lot of fear during this debate the first time it took place a couple of years ago, as you know, that on the police department side, that having Humvees, having armed personnel carriers, having big armor, militarized the police, made them feel not like community cops, but like soldiers. Do you think that's still a danger?
If it's not utilized properly, it certainly is going to give fear and create a great deal of concern and pause of people across America. So on any given day, if you and I decide 100 people follow us out for a protest and we're merely exercising our First Amendment rights, and even if we get a little rowdy, that's no reason to bring out militarized equipment. But of course, if for some reason dangerous weapons are now introduced into that environment in a way that we need to protect officers to secure that threat and protect our citizens, and then it's good to have that equipment there. But it's when it's introduced, there's policy with it, and you have a community that's saying, yes, we want to have that type of equipment in our community to meet whatever threat is there, but it's not going to be used arbitrarily or just on a whim.
Well, Dr. Alexander, you're presenting a very balanced, kind of informed approach here, but I want to talk about the message coming from the top, because President Trump earned a lot of rebukes from a lot of law enforcement officials weeks ago when he said to police departments, you should not be too nice to suspected gang members that you apprehend and that roughing them up would be okay. This is illegal, clearly. What's the overall message, given what the president said and given the reversal of this ban now, that the Trump administration is sending to departments, and do you approve of it?
When he made that statement a couple of weeks ago in upstate New York in Suffolk County, the inference was taken to mistreat prisoners. And if you recall, International Association Chiefs of Police, National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and a number of other professional law enforcement agencies, including Suffolk County PD, said, hey, wait a minute. That's not how we do business as a professional police organization. So that point was made very clear. It certainly was not a good message, whether he meant it or whether, as they came along later to say, he was joking about it. When you're the commander in chief, every word comes out of your mouth, people are going to take seriously, and particularly in the context when it comes to police community relations. We have done a lot of work over the years to help build and bridge those relationships. And we have to continue to do that. But all of us have to be very careful, including the president, not to send that type of message. And then when you're saying now, a couple of weeks later, we want officers to have access to militarized equipment, we have to draw very distinct and clear lines. Is that, okay, I made a statement over here that's of grave concern. I'm making another statement in which people in the community are still very much concerned about, and that's militarized equipment. That's why I'm marking this very clearly and trying to make sure that myself and the American people understand that if militarized equipment is brought into your community, you need to have input on it. There needs to be policy. It needs to be training. But certainly that message 2 weeks ago was not a very good message, and it certainly did not work for law enforcement. And that's why you heard law enforcement across this country push back on that statement and say, wait a minute, that's not how we do business.
Dr. Cedric Alexander, Deputy Mayor of Rochester, New York, thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And on Monday, a new law called the Trust Act was signed in Illinois.
We live in a diverse region, a diverse state, and every person living here deserves our protection. We have a special message for immigrants today. We want you to report crimes. We don't want you to be hesitant to call the police if you need them.
That's Stephen Stelter with the Illinois Association of Chiefs of Police on Monday. And here's Republican Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner signing the Trust Act yesterday.
I asked leaders in law enforcement, should I veto this bill or sign this bill? They all said to me, Governor, this is a reasonable compromise.
That compromise the governor is talking about says state and local officials in Illinois do not have to comply with requests from federal immigration authorities to continue holding detainees suspected of being in the country illegally. Odette Youssef is a reporter for WBEZ in Chicago who's been following the Trust Act closely. She joins me now from Chicago. Odette, welcome.
Thank you.
What exactly does the Trust Act do?
The Trust Act is a pretty narrow piece of legislation. Basically, what it says is that local and state law enforcement will not comply with what are called administrative detainer requests. These are warrantless detentions of people who may be suspected of being here without papers. And these are requests that Immigration and Customs Enforcement sends to local law enforcement agencies, basically asking them to hold a person for an additional 48 hours so they can come and pick them up and try to determine whether they are here with papers or not. And basically what the Trust Act says is we're not going to comply unless there's a warrant.
So you say it's pretty narrow. What does this look like in the real world? Somebody's being held as a suspect, I don't know, in a shoplifting, and then the feds want 48 hours to get to that person.
That's right. So if the person's already in custody of law enforcement, ICE might, you know, request that they hold on to that person for 48 hours, even after they've already completed their time. But this also addresses concerns that individuals may have that if they have any type of interaction with law enforcement, whether that be because they've reported a crime or they're trying to cooperate as witnesses in a case or something like that, if they have any interaction with public safety officials, they don't want to feel scared that that could ultimately end up with them being detained on questions of whether they are unauthorized or not.
So was that an important part, Odette Youssef, of building support for this here? I mean, we heard Steve Stelter with the chiefs of police at the top there saying we don't want you to be afraid to report crimes, to deal with police. That seems to be what he's talking about.
Yeah, that's the reason that it's called the Trust Act. The whole idea, I think, was to try to sort of bolster the idea that people, whether they're here legally or not, should be able to reach out to law enforcement and feel that they can trust them.
I mean, immigration can be so divisive, as I mentioned, and any bill in this country that basically says law enforcement back off, which is what this does to the feds here in Illinois, usually engenders a ton of controversy. But it seems like in Illinois, this coalition got it done fairly easily.
I wouldn't quite say that. You know, I think there were a few different sort of legs to the stool on which the support sort of came together to give Governor Rauner the cover that he really needed to support this bill. but it still wasn't easy to enlist the support of the various stakeholders. The interesting thing about the Trust Act is that it started as a more than 40-page long document. There were various other provisions relating to immigrants that were in there initially, such as creating so-called safe zones at schools and hospitals for undocumented immigrants. All of that had to be stripped out as part of this compromise, so that ultimately what they ended up with was just this very narrow provision relating to these warrantless detainer requests.
Odette Youssef with WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
President Trump visits Texas today to survey the damage from Hurricane Harvey. Back in Washington, there are new revelations in the ongoing investigation into possible ties between Trump aides and Russia. On Monday, the Washington Post and the New York Times learned that in the months leading up to the 2016 campaign, President Trump's business was actively pursuing a deal to build a massive Trump Tower in Moscow. According to emails obtained by the Times, a Russian-born developer and associate of Trump's named Felix Sater suggested that Vladimir Putin would help Trump win the presidency. According to the paper, Sater wrote in an email to Trump's lawyer, Richard Cohen, and here's a quote, "Our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. I will get all Putin's team to buy in on this. I will manage this process." Sater later writes, "I will get Putin on this program and we will get Donald elected." Now, there's no evidence that Sater delivered on his promise, and Trump's team says no one ever took him up on his offer to travel to Moscow. But Sater's emails and his relationship to the president and to Vladimir Putin are attracting interest from investigators now. With us is Rosalind Helderman. She's political investigations reporter with The Washington Post. Rosalind, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what I just read from Felix Sater seems pretty suspicious, given all the other reporting around Trump associates and Russians, and given the Russian election interference that Robert Mueller and congressional investigators are all looking into. So what do we know?
Those emails came from this guy, Felix Sater. We've started to hear already, sort of in the last 24 hours, what the defense to this is going to be from the Trump Organization. And that is that Mr. Sater was known for his salesmanship and being a sort of colorful character. And they've tried to suggest that his emails were perhaps exaggerated and that they were not necessarily taken tremendously seriously within the Trump Organization. His correspondent, a longtime friend of his who is a close aide to Donald Trump named Michael Cohen, indicated in a statement that he's provided to Congress that we obtained yesterday that he was not routinely apprising others within the Trump Organization about the things that Mr. Sater was saying on this project. And in fact, he had spoken to Donald Trump about it only three times.
We've talked about Felix Sater on this show before, Rosalind, his years of business dealings with Donald Trump in New York, and that the president later said he barely knew Sater and couldn't even recognize him in a room if he saw him. But who is Felix Sater, and what do we know about his relationship with Vladimir Putin?
Right. Well, as you said, he is a guy with a quite colorful background. He spent some time in jail in the early 1990s after a bar fight in which he stabbed a man in the face with the stem of a broken margarita glass. In 1998, he pled guilty for his role in a $40 million mafia-related stock fraud. He served no jail time for that because he spent years afterwards secretly assisting the FBI and the CIA in national security and organized crime investigations. And as you said, there's this interesting history. He had an office in Trump Tower and did business with the Trump Organization for years. And yet Donald Trump has always claimed to barely know the man. That's one of the reasons why his reappearance in the midst of the presidential campaign late 2015 into early 2016 is so very interesting. One thing we don't really know is the exact nature of his ties in Russia. He was born in Russia. He moved to the United States as a small child. He was raised in Brooklyn. We do know that he had ties there. He appeared to have assisted the FBI on, Russian organized crime related matters, among other things. But we don't know whether he truly had the connections that his emails to Mr. Cohen would suggest.
How important are these emails?
They're important not just for the Russia investigation, but for showing the way that Donald Trump's business interests intermingled with his political campaign. One of the things they show is that there was an active effort on the part of the Trump organization to make a business deal and make money in a part of the world that was important on the campaign trail. As for whether it shows collusion, that I just don't know yet. I think each of these windows were getting into things that were going on within the Trump organization and the Trump campaign provide new information that we didn't know at the time. But it's going to take Robert Mueller and his investigation to see whether these things are all linked together or just are a series of interesting coincidences.
Rosalind Helderman with The Washington Post, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. It's late August, and that means back to school time is around the corner. Usually when we talk about school, it's elementary school or high school or even graduation. But we wanted to take a little time over the next few days to talk about education for the littlest students in pre-kindergarten. Across the country, about 1.5 million four-year-olds are enrolled in some form of publicly funded early education. That's according to the Department of Education. Those numbers have been increasing steadily in recent years. Still, millions of children have no real access to pre-K or early childhood education at all. Who gets access and what the quality of that access is can all depend on the state and the city where you live. Later this week, we'll be looking at the science behind early education, but today we wanted to look at the basic question of who has access to pre-K and who doesn't.
About 40% of four-year-olds currently participate in some type of publicly funded pre-K program.
Abby Lieberman is a policy analyst on the Early and Elementary Education Policy Team at New America, and she says that access to early childhood education is growing, but still spotty.
The vast majority of these children are in a state-funded program. Last year, state-funded programs served about 1.5 million children, which is higher than ever before. So enrollment in these programs has been increasing slowly but steadily over the last decade or so. But progress has been really uneven. So whether a four-year-old attends a public pre-K program largely depends on the state or even the city that he or she lives in. States like Florida, Oklahoma, D.C., and Wisconsin all lead the way in access, serving more than 70% of four-year-olds. But like you mentioned, a handful of other states haven't started pre-K programs at all. In those states, Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, there is no state option for pre-K. And then some local governments have also stepped up and expanded access instead of waiting for the state to do so. So in cities like San Antonio, Philadelphia, of course, New York City's program is talked about and analyzed all the time. There are examples of cities that have really made early learning a priority.
You say public access to pre-K. Does that mean that in these jurisdictions, these states or cities that you're talking about, it's basically public school, just like first grade, third grade, fifth grade?
Sure. So that's one way to look at it. When we say publicly funded pre-K, it doesn't necessarily mean, though, that it's in an elementary school. It can be an elementary school. They can also receive public funding in a center-based program. Depending on the state or district, this will vary where they are serving students in pre-K. And no setting is inherently better than another. It depends on what works for parents, for children, and what the state and local government decides to do.
The Obama administration had a push relatively early in the administration for what they called universal pre-K. The idea here being federally funded pre-K so that every school district, I imagine, across America could have it. Whatever happened with that proposal, did it gain enough support in Congress that it could be something that could happen in the future?
So the Obama administration did make funding for early learning a really high priority, and especially for pre-K. So they did this through mostly competitive grant programs that were encouraging states to invest more and build out their programs. The Trump administration has not expressed much interest in pre-K and has not proposed any increases in funding in this area. But the federal government still does play a role in pre-K, mainly through the Head Start program, which gets about $9 billion each year. The Head Start program serves many of the country's lowest income families, and it's been around for more than 50 years and has bipartisan support in Congress.
So I asked the question about federal investment because on the state level, you know, states have budgets that are strapped and nobody wants to cut high schools. So it seems like in states that have confrontations with budget deficits or budget problems, that pre-K is often the first thing to get cut.
Yes, oftentimes pre-K is subject to cuts when budgets are tight. We saw this during the recession when many states spent less on pre-K. This is for a few reasons. Pre-K is new. It's also optional in all states, and it's already part-time in many states, so it's easier to cut slots when children aren't required to attend. It's also because of the way that pre-K is often funded. So according to the Education Commission of the states, only 9 states in D.C. include pre-K programs in their state education funding formulas. Other states are funding pre-K maybe through a lottery or a sales tax, like a soda tax. But when it's included in the state funding formula, it signifies that pre-K is part of the public education system and might make it more difficult to cut because the funding is sustained over time. It's not an annual decision. For these reasons, it's unfortunate that pre-K is often subject to cuts.
So if only 9 states include it in the formula, meaning it's an official part of public education, that means it sort of hangs out on a budget limb in other states and jurisdictions, right? I mean, how far along are state and local politicians along this path of starting to think of universal pre-K as part of education, just like fifth grade?
It varies all across the board. And in terms of universal programs, some states are choosing to expand access, make it universal. But when funding is limited, others are choosing to target certain groups of kids, such as low-income families, those with special needs, dual language learners, and the kids that can really stand to benefit the most. So states are making tough decisions, whether it's fund more with less money, fund less with more money, and how to get those funds.
So Abby Lieberman, you mentioned that 40% of children nationwide have access to publicly funded pre-K. What about the other 60%? Their parents can pay cash for it, I guess, on the private pre-K market. What are those kids doing?
So the rest of the kids, like you said, might be in private pre-K programs where their parents are paying out of pocket. This can be prohibitively expensive. We often hear the statistic that childcare is more expensive than public college tuition in some states. And pre-K is also coming at a time when, you know, parents often don't have the savings. They can't afford these programs. So other parents might be reliant on federal subsidies. Other parents might choose to stay home with their children. Of course, this is becoming less common as more households have all parents working outside the home. Also, family, friend, and neighbor care. So, you know, children staying with neighbors, with grandparents is also very common throughout the U.S.
Let me get you into the prediction business. Do you expect more states and jurisdictions to expand pre-K in their jurisdictions? Where does this go?
So I'm reluctant to make predictions, but I think, you know, pre-K access has been expanding over the last decade or so, and I don't see this changing. Pre-K is one of the few areas where there is bipartisan support, and I think that really reflects a shift in the national attitude towards the value of early education. So state and local governments are stepping up and they're expanding access and responding to the needs of their constituents. The research is there, and how to fund it is really, really the obstacle that a lot of policymakers are dealing with.
Abby Lieberman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Abby Lieberman is policy analyst on the Early and Elementary Education Policy Team at New America. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and back to the city of Houston now in our ongoing coverage of Hurricane Harvey. Houston is a sprawling city. It's the 4th most populous in all of America, with actual boundaries covering more than the state of New Jersey. Now, Houston's not in Louisiana, but still, it's called the Bayou City. That's because of the 10 waterways that wind right through it. But with that charm comes a lot of risk. The city's main water artery is called Buffalo Bayou, and it's expected to crest 14 feet above previous records by the time Harvey and its rains have retreated. Here's Bennett Teer again. He's the Houston resident who you heard from at the top of the show today, who was forced to evacuate on Monday.
There's several bayous that run all through this part of Texas. And when you get that much rain north of us and on top of us, the bayous are soon just inundated. And the water has really nowhere to go. And there's a lot of choke points where the water finally gets together and then goes out in the Gulf of Mexico. And they're just overwhelmed right now. So any amount of rain we get, it's trouble.
And it's not a new problem in Houston. Storms over the past few years have raised alarms among scientists and engineers in Texas. They warn that Houston wouldn't be ready for a storm like Harvey, and certainly not for a storm that's worse. Phil Bedient is an engineering professor at Rice University and co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction Center. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I was reading some facts about Houston. It sits an average of 43 feet above sea level, I learned. But describe the landscape of Houston and all these waterways we're talking about and how an engineer like you looks at them.
Well, Houston is very, very flat. It literally is probably one of the flattest major metropolitan areas anywhere, certainly in the United States. So we have a drop or a slope that is less than 1 foot per mile. And because of that, we have very slow draining systems. And of course, we also get lots and lots of very intense rainfalls. We have mostly clay soils. And we have very, very rapid urbanization that's taken place, especially over the last 25 years within the city. So these, all of these sort of combine together to create a, if you will, a perfect storm for flood problems.
And it seems like you and other engineers knew that. Last year, well before Harvey was on anyone's radar, you said that Houston was a sitting duck, ripe for a destructive storm just like this. Why did you say that?
Well, I've been looking at these problems for many, many years. And I started at Rice literally more than four decades ago. And I've been watching these floods for many years. And we're just in a situation where if you get an extreme amount of rainfall as this particular event brought. Now, of course, we've had that before. We had very extreme rainfalls with Tropical Storm Allison back in 2001, which was actually a very similar event to this one, except that in this case, it just sat and didn't move and just pumped water in off of the Gulf and dropped, in fact, more than about 24 to 30 inches of rain over the entire Houston area, all of the bayous, the entire county, and even some counties nearby. And so you put all of that water in any major metropolitan area, I don't care where you are, you're going to have flood problems. There's no way to design a system to handle that much water. It's well above a 100-year design level, and that's typically what we design to.
And that design is a critical question. I understand how difficult it is to have that 100-year outlook, but you described Houston as a big, flat pan with clay so it doesn't drain well. Talk about design a little bit. Is this a major flaw of human engineering here in Houston, or was this the best that people could do over many, many years of a city growing outward?
Well, that's an interesting question. Actually, there are ways to have done a better job on Houston if we had started early on. We learned a lot about urban runoff over the years. We started to really come out of that in the 90s and post-Tropical Storm Allison, but the problem in most of Houston, it was a day late and a dollar short in that most of the developments were already in close to the bayous. There was very little room for expansion of these bayous. And more importantly, we didn't have the room upstream to put in reservoirs to catch that water at the upper end of the watershed. We only have two of those in the city. Those are both on Buffalo Bayou, but they are being stressed beyond belief, again, due to Harvey.
So let's talk about solutions, and I know how difficult they are in a city as big as Houston and as sprawling as it is. Walk us to your whiteboard for a second, Professor Bedient, and walk us through some of the possible solutions in a city as big as Houston that could help it avoid floods or to drain faster in the future.
Sure, and there are examples around Houston where they have done, I think, a better job using better policies, better flood control policies, putting in more green space, allowing more room for the rivers to flow and the bayous to flow. And, you know, to the north and to the west of Houston, there are examples where, in fact, relatively minor flooding has occurred during these major events of Harvey. But to now go back in and retrofit, that's the difficult task. So we're talking about really having to get much more serious with buyouts of houses that are flooding over and over again. And so there are many areas where these buyouts should take place, and then those areas should be turned into detention ponds. We should also be considering pump storage detention. By that I mean just like they do in South Florida. We're so flat and the drainage is so low in many areas that we could consider the idea of actually holding some of this stormwater back and then pumping it out at a later time. Right now, there are very few pump storage systems anywhere in Houston.
So, Phil Bedient, we've talked a lot about engineering, and before we let you go, I just want to ask you about people, because we always hear these stories of the scientist, the engineer, screaming warnings when everything seems fine. that everything might not be fine. Is there anything we can do to convince policymakers, convince all of us as people to heed warnings like yours sooner? I mean, what's it feel like to know that you were yelling this in some ways and that people didn't react?
Well, it is disconcerting that we have not done a better job of this in the Houston area. We've done as well as we probably could do during this storm in terms of responding to it. But the idea of fishing thousands of people out of high water is a difficult proposition. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't be very proactive in trying to address this problem for the smaller storms, the 100-year storms that seem to hit us and have hit us almost every year in the last couple of years. So in that regard, you know, you look at the scenes on television and it's very disconcerting and very, you know, I mean, it leaves me with a sense of great sadness that a smart city like Houston, where we're medical leaders and we are space leaders and all of that, we need to do a better job of putting green space and green infrastructure back into the fabric of the community to help alleviate these problems.
Phil Bedient, engineering professor at Rice University and co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction Center. Professor, thanks a lot.
You bet. Thank you for the call.
For many Americans, the flooding in Houston served as a major wake-up call, and we wanted to know, is your city ready for a major emergency? What about your family?
This is Holly in Portland, Oregon. Our family has plans in case of catastrophic events, but we realized after watching the events in Texas this past week, we need to revision and back up our plans. We realize now that mass evacuation is not reasonable or possible in almost any circumstance.
This is Dee Dee, and I live in San Francisco. I was here for the 89 earthquake, and I have supplies ready in case I have to shelter in place. But I must admit that I borrowed from my bottled water supply. Houston is a good reminder to check my supplies and make sure my emergency kit is up to date and all in one place. The big one could happen any day.
Voices from all over Houston today as residents cope with the flooding. And your voices, too, as the country watches their American neighbors recover. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. We always want to hear from you. You can send your tweets at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state that has instituted and prioritized the Learn to Code movement in K-12 education. Learn more about the Computer Science Initiative at arkansasedc.com.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.